Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, the Chemistry World Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the ninth episode of the Chemistry World Podcast with me, Azzy Kateri. This month, what the outgoing Prime Minister did and didn't do for science in the UK.
For a Prime Minister, Tony Blair, who came in saying his priorities were education, education and education, it is a disgrace that 16% of secondary schools do not have a chemistry teacher of any kind, and that means a million children are being taught chemistry in school today by people who aren't chemistry teachers.
Also, a different way of saving the environment by removing atmospheric carbon dioxide.
Every houseman or housewife knows that if you put your cake for too long in the oven, it's turning into carbon. And we are doing something very similar.
And the science that is too green to be true.
Researchers are rather afraid to frame their work in green chemistry terms because they think the terms become so devalued by everyone saying, oh, my work is green. And not framing your work as green means that you're not thinking about the whole reaction process.
That's all to come later on in the programme. But first, the outgoing UK Prime Minister Tony Blair may have cause to worry about his international legacy, but UK science has much to thank him for. Or does it? To find out, Chris Smith spoke to Peter Cotgreave, the director of the Campaign for Science and Engineering in the UK, and asked him what Tony Blair has done for chemistry in this country.
He's done a number of things for science in general from which chemistry has benefited. And the most obvious one of those is that the science research budget has doubled during Tony Blair's government. And one of the most important things that's happened with it is that the infrastructure for research, particularly in universities, which was in the most appalling and crumbling state when Tony Blair came to power, is now being rejuvenated. And you can't go to any university in the country without seeing cranes and men in hard hats building fantastic new laboratories, and many of those will be chemistry laboratories or be laboratories in which some chemistry is being done.
Sounds rosy, but this comes at a time when I know of several chemistry departments that have faced or are facing potential closure because they've had a problem attracting people, because they've had a problem with funding.
Yeah.
And also other people would argue, yes, doubling the budget is a big step forward, but for years it's been so underfunded it could have done with more like quadrupling to get us up to the rest of the world's standards.
Yeah, I think that's perfectly fair. I don't think you can blame Tony Blair for the fact that the infrastructure was in such an appalling state when he came over. But it is true that even though we have doubled the amount of money we put into research in this country, the rest of the world hasn't stood still, and the UK is still not even average among the G7 group of industrialised countries. So there's still a long way to go.
So what are you going to tell Gordon Brown if you have the opportunity that he needs to do about this?
Well, we do have the opportunity. We're going into the Treasury in July, within about 3 weeks of Gordon Brown taking office. And I think there are two very obvious ones, and there's a third issue, where the government under Tony Blair and with Gordon Brown as Chancellor have not delivered. And one of them relates to that issue of chemistry departments closing, and it is to do with the education system. We are not getting through to young people that chemistry and other science subjects are exciting and rewarding. That's why not enough people want to do chemistry, and that's one reason why some chemistry departments have closed. And for a Prime Minister, Tony Blair, who came in saying his priorities were education, education and education, it is a disgrace that 16% of secondary schools do not have a chemistry teacher of any kind, and that means a million children are being taught chemistry in school today by people who aren't chemistry teachers.
That's not a very rosy picture you're painting,
that,
Peter.
On that issue, on the issue of education, which is crucial to the future, they have failed. Gordon Brown says he wants to do something about it, but he really needs to get to grips with that. I think a second issue that he needs to get to grips with for the research community is that a lot of the new money has come with strings attached to it, and it's become very difficult for academic researchers to fulfill their traditional strength, which is in doing very novel, very new things and generating ideas that are outside the general paradigm that everyone in industry and everywhere else is working. And the third thing, which both of those two things I think feed into, is that they've not yet made the UK a really attractive place for private sector investment in research and development. And that's important in chemistry because the chemical industry has traditionally been strong in the UK. And if we don't deliver those people from the education system in the schools, if we don't deliver that novel research coming out of the universities, and if we don't have a tax regime and other factors that make the UK attractive, then we will lose that chemical industry in the future. So those are kind of the three broad areas where Gordon Brown and his new team of ministers really got to get to grips with.
Peter Cotgreave, the director of the Campaign for Science and Engineering, preparing to give Gordon Brown a piece of his mind. Now, moving quickly away from politics, a new scientific study has shown that plants may not be contributing to the greenhouse effect by producing methane after all. Here's Chris Smith talking to Chemistry World science correspondent Richard Van Norden.
Richard, there's interesting news about plants and methane, because last year, fierce speculation that plants may be a major source of methane, it was subsequently refined down, and now you're saying it could also be completely rubbish.
Yeah, last year, Frank Kepler at the Max Planck Institute for Chemistry in Germany really stunned the scientific world when he said that plants belched out methane gas. Didn't seem to be any reason for this, since they've got quite enough carbon dioxide and oxygen to breathe out to get energy and keep them happy. I mean, normally you get bacteria giving out methane from cows' stomachs, from the Earth's crust, and scientists think they understand the sources and sinks of methane. Now, with these plants, Kepler estimated that the methane they gave out could be quite a lot of the proportion of total methane given out. That really threw off our understanding of what sources and sinks of methane were. But now, Tom Dweck of Wageningen University in the Netherlands says his team has made the first independent check on this claim, and they found that plants don't emit any methane at all.
Well, how did he do it, and how could the initial research have gone so wrong to have said there is all this methane then?
And what Dweck did was he fed his plants on carbon-13 isotopes. If they gave out any methane, it would be carbon-13 labelled methane, which would be very easy to detect among the carbon-12 methane in the air. And he didn't detect any carbon-13 methane. What Kepler appears to have done is that he didn't have this labelling approach. What he did was he sucked the air out of the container holding the plants and flushed it with something like nitrogen, took away all the atmospheric methane away because it would be quite hard to detect any more methane over the atmospheric level. And then he said, right, any more methane that I see must have come from the plant. But Dweck reckons that he didn't quite realise that methane can stay trapped in little pores in the soil and in plant leaves. And as he flushed the air out and flushed it with nitrogen, a diffusion gradient of methane might have come back out of the plant. It wasn't really being made by the plant, it just got trapped there. It was there to start with.
And so when you take the labelling approach, of course, there was no labelled methane there before, and hence you don't see any.
Exactly. Now, it's only fair to say that Kepler comes back and says, of course he didn't do such a thing. He knew very well that was a problem. But Dweck says, you know, he may not have accounted for it completely. And Kepler comes back and says, well, this labelling approach may actually change the way the plants see their metabolism. If everything they have is labelled carbon-13, maybe their metabolism is going to be a bit different, which Dweck thinks not much of. But there's certain controversy between those two, but in fact many other scientists are weighing into this debate as well, saying that they are about to publish papers on one or other side of the argument that plants emit methane or don't emit methane. So we're kind of looking forward to this one with interest.
We shall indeed. So watch this space. Now, researchers from the Whitehead Institute for Biomedical Research in the US have identified crucial behaviour-controlling subsections of prions. These are protein particles thought to be infectious agents responsible for neurodegenerative diseases such as Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease or CJD. Chris Smith spoke to the Chemistry World science correspondent James Mitchell Crowe.
These researchers have been studying prions and have been looking at short subsections of the prion protein, which they've termed recognition elements. And these short subsections control quite a few aspects of the way that the prions behave, from the way that they fold, or rather the way that they misfold, to the way that they could potentially cross from one species to another species.
So what do these elements do normally? What's their role apart from diseases?
Well, they're just a part of the total protein structure. So normally these proteins are folded in a particular way, but something might trigger one of them to misfold, and then that triggers all the neighbouring proteins to misfold in the same way. So it's kind of a cascade reaction. So this is why prions can cause disease in mad cow disease, BSE, and Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease.
And the way in which the two proteins actually interact is via this particular domain that is being studied here.
That's right, yes. If you just isolate this one particular short sequence and add it to a normally folded protein, then all the normally folded proteins will be triggered to misfold in that way.
So how did those scientists then extend that finding?
What they did was they were studying prions in fungi. One was in a yeast and one was in a different species of fungi. And they took the prions that are native to both of these species, cut them in half so that this particular recognition element of each species was still present in the half that they kept. And then they knitted those two together to form a chimera prion. When they tested this chimera in both species, the protein misfolding was triggered in both cases, which shows that it is this particular short recognition element which triggers the misfolding of all the other protons.
Necessary and sufficient for the disease to occur. So is that how we think it might have the capacity to jump from one species to the next as well?
That's right, yeah. The researchers have postulated that natural prions may have more than one recognition element, and so that's how they might be able to trigger protein misfolding in more than one species.
So BSE out of a cow into a human.
That's right, yeah. So that's what they're planning to do next, to test mammalian prions and see if the same thing might be happening there.
James Mitchell-Crowe explaining how new research is gradually unfolding the mysteries of infectious prions. On the way, how Afghanistan is getting on top of its geological surveys, and how China is seeking alternative routes to remedy an ailing environment and a growing energy demand. But first, rising levels of atmospheric greenhouse gases have prompted many scientists to look for ways of controlling and even reducing the global levels of CO2. Now, researchers at the Max Planck Institute in Potsdam, Germany, have shown that cooking waste biomass at 200 degrees centigrade in a pressure cooker with some citric acid thrown in as a catalyst is an energy-efficient way of producing coal. They believe this can offer a real solution for the CO2 problem. Here's Marcus Antonietti talking to Chris Smith.
Every year we drill 4 cubic kilometers of oil, and these transfer in about 13 cubic kilometers of CO2 once taken as a solid. This sounds like a big number, but if we consider that the yearly production of plant material is about 120 cubic kilometers, and this is some type of bound CO2 too, indeed the oil problem is minor as compared to what the planet is generating as plant material.
Doesn't it make a difference, though, that that plant material represents carbon that's already in the atmosphere? It's not de novo liberated carbon that's at the moment sequestered away like oil is.
Well, indeed, the plant material, of course, is created from CO2, but the usual problem of plant material is that it decomposes into CO2 again. So the art has to be, indeed, to take the plant material and transfer it into something more permanent, to sequester the carbon.
So in the same way as over millions of years we made coal and oil, I suppose you're saying find a way to recreate that process.
This is exactly right. There are just a few effective carbon sinks on Earth, and funny enough, the most active nowadays are Scottish swamps. Swamps later on transfer into brown coal and black coal.
But the natural process of making coal takes millions to hundreds of millions of years. So how can you do it in a timescale that's going to be compatible with reversing climate change? Because current predictions would give us, what, 20, 30 years?
Yes, but this is exactly the art of chemistry, of course. Once you have analyzed the natural process, you have to worry about ways to accelerate the process. And this can be done by increasing the temperature, by adding catalysts, by increasing the pressure. And indeed, if you do the carbonization of biomass at about 200 degrees centigrade and 20 bars of water pressure, then the whole process can be accelerated down to 16 hours.
So what's actually happening when you do this? What are the conditions you need? And what's actually happening to the carbohydrates in there to turn it into something resembling coal?
If you look into the chemistry of swamps, you see that the carbohydrates are just dehydrated. And if you dehydrate a carbohydrate, carbon is left. So qualification is nothing but elimination of water. And we can quite effectively control this at elevated temperatures. But every houseman or housewife knows that if you put your cake for too long in the oven, it's turning into carbon. And we are doing something very similar.
Now, how much energy does it actually take to do this, though, Marcus? Because if it's going to cost us more in terms of carbon release into the atmosphere to power this process, then we've got no net gain.
Well, this was, in fact, a big surprise for us, because this process is not costing energy, it liberates energy. And thinking about it again, it has to be like that, because all natural processes which are spontaneous are exothermic. And in fact, this process is highly exothermic. So in the very end, we don't have to add energy. Sometimes we even have too much energy and we have to carry away the heat to keep the process in a controlled fashion.
Have you just done this on the small scale, or have you tried this on the big scale, on the kind of scale we're going to need if it's going to make an impact on climate change?
The biggest amount I ever did is 1 kilogram. And we are currently planning with engineering partners to set up larger constructions to prove, indeed, that the process also works on a larger scale.
Now, where do you propose getting this biomass from? Because presumably a lot of it is coming out of places that are inaccessible, the Amazon rainforest, for example. How are you actually going to get it and get it to one of these reactors?
Well, this is, again, not too difficult, because I'm talking 120 cubic kilometres of biomass, but about 15 cubic kilometres are already part in farming cycles. So what I indeed propose is to treat the agricultural waste. So you harvest the grains, of course, but you drop the straw. You harvest rapeseed, but you drop rapeseed straw. You harvest the sugar of sugar cane, but you drop the canes. And usually this type of waste is about 90% of the harvest. So think about the sugar cane. There's a cubic kilometer of sugar cane leftovers in Brazil, which could be immediately treated, taking care of already 10% of the worldwide CO2 problem. So the answer is these machines have to be where biomass is agro-industrially cultivated.
Marcus Antonietti, the director of the Max Planck Institute of Colloids and Interfaces, with a vision of tackling climate change by recapturing the carbon from agricultural waste. Now, to most people, the words green chemistry may sound like a genuinely ethical way of looking after the environment. Unfortunately, recent reports are showing a decline in support for the green bandwagon. Chris Smith spoke to Richard Van Norden to find out more.
Green chemistry is essentially making chemical processes and substances which are less hazardous to the environment and to humans. So it's a laudable aim. You'd think everyone would be for that. And since it was invented in the 1990s, it was sometimes seen as a bit soft. But since then, it's got journals, it's got funding in the UK, it's been focused on a set of 12 principles of green chemistry, which really push things down to things like use atom economy and try and make reactions as efficient as possible, try and make them easy to clean up. So you've really got things to focus on, and now it seems green chemistry is a much more established field. But with all this support has come researchers who seem to label their chemistry green without truly thinking about it.
So they sound like quite laudable aims. And so you're saying that people are now subverting the green label to nefarious ends then?
Well, I'm not saying necessarily nefarious. In fact, István Horváth, a European researcher in Hungary, suggested that people might not be seeing that a reaction is green, almost naively not thinking about it properly. Because what they're doing is they're just looking at one area of a process. So, for example, they're saying water is a really green solvent. It's water, it's not toxic. If it leaks, never mind. But if you're, for example, using water in a reaction that happens to use organic molecules as a catalyst, what you're left with at the end of the process may be water contaminated with organic molecules, which could be as hard and as energy intensive to clean up as organic molecules themselves. You could have used them all along, you know, as an organic solvent.
And although, is that you're actually worse off for having tried to be green then? Is that what you're saying?
Well, a recent paper published in Angewandte Chemie suggests that we may indeed, in this instance, be worse off. Essentially, the point is that you've got to think a lot more carefully about this than just saying, oh, I've replaced the nasty solvent, so now things are much better. And Ken Seddon, who works at Queen's University Belfast, he suggested to me that green chemistry publications have peaked and are on the decline. He thinks that researchers are rather afraid to frame their work in green chemistry terms because they think the term has become so devalued by everyone saying, oh, my work is green. And not framing your work as green means that you're not thinking about the whole reaction process. You're not saying, I'm making this bit of it green, but I need to acknowledge that I should have thought about what's happening at the end of the process, what's happening at the beginning of the process.
Is it not driven by market forces anyway, though, Richard? So if a process is cheaper to do a certain way, isn't industry going to do that anyway? And therefore, to make it worth someone's while to do something in a green way, you've got to have quite a lot of incentives, I would think.
Well, industry's always been doing green chemistry because it is economically good to reduce waste. But we're talking about academia coming up with new ideas out of Blue Sky Science that they're trying to push into industry. And if academics aren't thinking seriously enough about whether their chemistry is green, that's not going to help industry, and it's not going to help the academic image of green chemistry as a serious subject.
Well, let's hope efficient and environmentally clean research prevails, whatever the labels may be. Now, Afghanistan has been on the news often for, well, bad news. But we never hear about how the country is improving or how international initiatives are lending expertise and funding to help build infrastructure for research. Well, here's a bit of good news, because earlier this week, Chris Smith spoke to Michael Watts, the deputy leader of the British Geological Survey Project in Afghanistan, who is off to do just that.
I'm heading off to Afghanistan in a few days, working on a project funded by the Department for International Development, which is funding a three-year project for the British Geological Survey to undertake the institutional strengthening of the Afghanistan Geological Survey. This involves capacity building, transfer of skills, rehabilitation of the Afghan Geological Survey.
Is Afghanistan very rich in geological deposits and minerals that could be exploited then? Is that a potential wealth earner for the country?
Afghanistan has potentially a bright future in terms of its mineral wealth. There are known deposits of a variety of metals, gold, silver, copper, zinc, semi-precious stones such as lapis, emeralds, rubies. There are also hydrocarbons, coal, natural gas and oil. So yes, it is abundant in natural resources.
So is the major problem facing Afghanistan at the moment? They just don't have the skills to get at that material and therefore realise the value of it?
Yes, in some respects there are the skills in exploiting the mineral resources. Some of the techniques are quite outdated, such as quarrying of marble. They will use dynamite, and they may end up losing a large portion of the marble deposit. So a survey will come in and advising ways of extracting such minerals. But a survey is also involved in attracting investors into the country, either Afghanistan investors or international investors.
So where do you come in?
Well, with the British Geological Survey, our remit is to rehabilitate the staff of the survey. We're doing that firstly by transfer of skills. So we're providing broad coverage of English language training, computer training, and basic geology. We're setting up a suite of laboratories, providing hands-on training. So far we have about four or five laboratories, and this summer we're about to bring on stream the last laboratory that is planned for this project. But we generally take a pretty pragmatic approach owing to the quite difficult conditions over there. The power supply, water supply is very unreliable. The actual knowledge base and technical skills base is quite low amongst the Afghan employees, partly because the survey hasn't been fully functioning for a number of years.
So what will the mission that you're going to embark on pretty shortly actually involve? Because you've got some of the stuff there already, but what are you actually going to be doing first and foremost when you get there? And is it going to pan out as you anticipate?
Well, that's one of the exciting things about the project, really. It's quite unpredictable. We have to be ready for sort of anything, really. Initially, I'm one of the rotating deputy project leaders. So initially, I'll be taking on and looking after the running of the project out there. Halfway through, I will swap to my main task of setting up the laboratories and really trying to set up a plan for the future so that they have a sustainable future whereby the Afghans can take over the running of the laboratories and eventually the survey itself beyond the end of our project, which will finish at the end of this September.
Are you apprehensive?
Apprehensive about going, yes. But that sort of happens every time. I mean, this will be my fifth trip. You can't help but see what is on the news and family and friends asking you what it's like out there. But actually on the ground, it's not quite as bad as the news makes out. And as long as you're sensible, don't take any risks and follow strict protocols that we have, we've been perfectly fine in the past. But obviously you can't take that for granted.
Michael Watts from the British Geological Survey, who has left for Afghanistan since that interview, and we wish him and all those involved every success with the project. Staying with news from abroad, last month, Chemistry World's editor Mark Peplow travelled to China to find out more about the role that chemistry is playing in the country's booming economy. In the first of two reports, Mark talks to some of the investors who are hoping to fuel China's future.
I'm in Beijing for the Achem Asia conference, biggest get-together for the chemical, pharmaceutical and biotech industries in China. There's about 20,000 scientists and business people here from 27 different countries. The sheer scale of this event tells you a great deal about the amazing developments in chemistry in this country. Interestingly, when you look down the programme for the conference, you see a real emphasis on biofuels, renewable energy, clean coal technology, environmental monitoring and so on. There's also a lot of talk about collaboration with Europe. One example of that interest comes from a university spin-out company called Biolique, based in Karlsruhe in Germany. They're finding ways to turn waste plant materials into liquid fuels and simple chemicals that normally come from oil. I spoke to Rainer Korber.
If you don't want change, everything what's on this world, cars, engines running, you need oil in some way, and that means a carbon source.
So what you're talking about is taking waste materials like straw, for example, and turning that into a form that can be easily transported, yes?
We can turn this in the gasifier into hydrogen and carbon monoxide. And for chemists, this is a ground syngas where you can build up a lot of chemical products, which at this time are refined out of crude oil.
In a country like Germany, can there ever be enough waste biomass to actually make any impression on the amount of petrol that you need to run all the cars in Germany, for example?
Oh, that is a good question. You know that raffineries are very big and they are developed up to the end. So to have this as a competitor is hard. I have to admit, at this time, you cannot compete with the price for a liter of diesel with a liter of syn fuel. Estimations are that we are around double the price in production, or maybe three times the price. But this makes us very hopeful because we are on a step to develop our technique. We built up a pilot plant in Karlsruhe, which can be fed with 500 kilograms per hour. But it's not too much, but I think this is a good next step.
You're halfway through building that pilot process plant in Karlsruhe. When do you expect to get your first usable fuel from this process?
Our goal is to run the plant in 2008. We had this aim to deliver the Olympic Games in Beijing with synthetic fuel to run the buses here.
So it's still early days for biofuels. What about a more traditional source of energy, coal? I asked Bernd Josef Leistenschneider from German chemical engineering company Lurgi why he'd come to Achem Asia and why he's interested in the black stuff.
Coal is important to Lurgi because coal is the basic source of China. The German energy consumption is about 25% based on coal. Japan is the same. The Chinese consumption is 75% based on coal. So China is the coal country of the world, besides the US and South Africa and India. The way from coal to a material which is feasible for public use is via a liquid. So we convert coal into a synthesis gas, and then the first liquid which we can receive from the synthesis gas is methanol. Mm-hmm. Therefore, methanol is the core material of all coal-to-liquids processes.
What sort of scale of methanol production would you actually need to make an impact in China?
The government of the NDRC, the Development and Reform Commission, they forecast the methanol production in the year 2020 of 60 million tons a year, based on 5 million tons a year in the year 2006.
That's a huge increase.
Yes.
How many plants will that require to be able to service that?
When we take the state-of-the-art size of plants of 1.6 million tons a year, then we talk about 40 plants. But the present situation in China is that they have very small plants, so they need to increase their technological capability to large plants.
As methanol production increases, does that mean that crude oil will decrease?
Or is the increase in methanol production just to feed the increased demand for cars and transport?
It's the second one. We decline the increase of the oil consumption by the substitution with methanol.
Now, one of the other interesting things, that you're working on a floating methanol factory, is that right?
Yes. China imports oil and China has a lot of coal. What is about all this gas which is around the world, especially those which cannot be used because it is removed from the final destination? So the idea came up to put methanol plant in a large scale on a ship which can be transported on the coast. We take the gas, convert it into methanol and transport the methanol to China.
Otherwise, that gas would just be burnt off, wouldn't it? It would just be flared, which in itself is a major source of carbon dioxide.
Yes. So there are a lot of arguments in order to build such a ship. Question, why isn't it not built today in a large scale? It's about feasibility. So, of course, a ship is more expensive, but as higher the oil prices are getting, as larger the demand for alternative resources is getting, as higher the impact on the feasibility.
Many of the people I've met here at Akam Asia keep telling me how conscious the Chinese are that their incredible economic growth comes with a real environmental price. For these companies here, China's efforts to develop more sustainably presents a business opportunity, but it's also a chance to minimise the growing impact this nation has on the earth. Next month, you can hear the second part of my report from China, when I'll be finding out more about universities here.
We'll hear more from Mark next month, and Chemistry World will be launching a Chinese edition later on during the year. So if you'd like to find out more about that, why not drop us an email to chemistryworld@rsc.org. Finally, it's time for our chemical conundrum. Last month, we asked you, why does wine cork? Here's Professor Susan Ebler of the Department of Viticulture and Enology, University of California, Davis, with the answer.
Corked wine comes from a chemical compound that forms in the cork, and when the wine is stored with the cork and comes into contact with the cork, then that chemical gets extracted from the cork and comes into the wine. The chemical compound is called trichloroanisole, and it forms in the cork from a variety of chemical processes. Most of them involve a microbial growth on the cork, taking precursor compounds that are in the cork and forming this chemical compound. Very small amounts, 5 nanograms of TCA in a liter of wine, is all it takes for us to be able to smell it. And even at very low concentrations, when we might not be able to smell it directly and recognize it as the TCA cork taint, it may have still an impact on the wine.
And the question we'd like you to help us with this month is, why does orange juice taste so awful after you've just brushed your teeth? Send us your answers to chemistryworld@rsc.org. Well, that's it for this month's episode. This program was produced and presented by me, Azzy Kateri, and Chris Smith from thenakedscientist.com, and Chemistry World's editor Mark Peplow, and science correspondents James Mitchell Crowe and Richard Van Norden. For more science, do check out the Chemistry World website at chemistryworld.org. And until next month, goodbye.